Welcome to the Evolution Exchange Nordics podcast. At Evolution, we are committed to helping people and Nordics tech organizations realize their true potential. Our goal is to develop deep relationships with individuals, building trust to make doing business easier. I'm Jacob Byerly from Evolution Recruitment Solutions, and today I will be your host. I'm joined by Daniel Brandt and Johan Ekvall, and today we'll be discussing sustainability in tech. Before we dive deeper into the topic, I guess we can sort of work our way between the two of you, a little bit of an introduction to yourself, maybe where you work, what your biggest passion is currently. Johan, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Thank you, Jacob. Yeah, my name is Johan Ekvall. I work as head of product at Wärtsilä Voyage, producing simulators for maritime training. Everything from training of deck officers, captains, to people involved in engine room operations or liquid cargo or bunkering operations and so on. So if you become a captain or a chief engineer, you probably run through a lot of simulation sessions based on our technology. Passion. Yeah, of course, my passion is in continuous development. I'm in the training field, of course. So that is what drives me every day to become better at whatever I want to do.
Perfect. And Daniel, moving on to yourself.
Yeah, my name is Daniel, and I'm a product manager at Sustainable Innovation and head of EU funding, and I mainly work with power grid related innovation projects, so distribution, digitalization, and so on, to kind of better see how we can accelerate the green energy transition. My passion is projects mainly. I don't particularly care that much about, like, if it's interesting and sort of half disruptive, then it's pretty fun to work at that, man. I'm happy that I work with sustainable energy and not in oil and gas, because that kind of makes the better place.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Bennett here, a Nordics Managing Director here at Evolution. We're committed to doing recruitment in a different way that adds value to both our clients and candidates by providing you with amazing speakers and leading-edge discussions on what's going on in the tech scene at the moment. There are three reasons why you should contact me. If you would like to speak on a future podcast, if you are interested in hiring awesome tech, data, product or gaming freelancers for your business, or if you are looking for an exciting new organization to work with, please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope to hear from you soon. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Cool. Thank you so much for that. And I guess now that we've established a little bit of context to each of you, we can sort of move into the topic in focus. You've both sort of brought a couple of questions to the panel, and as usual, I'll work myself between the two of you, asking you to maybe pose your question and then maybe the reasons behind why you brought it to the panel. And then, of course, each of you will have your opportunity to take on the question, give your answer. So, Daniel, why don't we start with yourself? Talk us through maybe the question that you've brought and why the reasoning is that you've brought it today.
So I guess my overarching question was, how to accelerate the green energy transition. There is, on the one hand, you have a constant decrease of cost per kilowatt hour for solar. Theoretically, that could also be transferred to wind. They are having some, I would say, financing issues, but I guess, so if you've read the news lately in energy, you've seen that large wind farms are not making a profit and they have to shut down and so on. My take on that is that they have some bad power purchase agreements where they've agreed to sell their energy for a specific price and to deliver at a specific price. And then the market goes bloop and they don't, like, they made a bad business decision. It's not necessarily that the kilowatt hour production from the wind power is bad. But I mean, that's my sort of take. But the European Union and the world have set very high ambitions in terms of renewable energy production, and with solar and etc. And there are Some interesting innovations coming through for long-term energy storage. Such one of the, my favorite one is from Gothenburg again. It's the Heat Vault company. I like them, and they do thermal storage. They heat up the rock. They dig down and they can heat it up to the melting point. You don't want that, but they theoretically could. And the normal way to store now is with water, and then you can store up to 70 degrees. But if you can store up to 600 degrees, then you get a very hot core. And the more you drill, the bigger you make the core, the more heat you can store, and the longer it can stay in the rock or in the, yeah. So you could, then you have these seasonal storage in terawatt hours, theoretically, or at least gigawatt hours, which becomes very interesting when you talk about solar production, because as everyone knows, when the sun don't shine, you don't get any production. But when the sun does shine, you get, can get a huge amount of production. So the acceleration of the energy storage, energy transition kind of is 2 points. One is storage. The other point is that we are, Europe and the world is basically in, we live in an infrastructure that was built and designed in the middle of the 1800s by the best and brightest of the minds at the time. And they continued that tradition. And it's served us very well up until this point, because the design of the grid is that you have central production, more or less, distribution and consumption. And then you always do that in parity. It's a very linear system. When you introduce renewable production or local production in general, then you stress the power grid in areas that are not designed to receive production. But solar production or renewable production is not centralized, it's very decentralized. So they pop up in areas where the grid is weak. And as such, the grid becomes a bottleneck for the transition. So in the Poland, between 2021 and 2022, the number of connection requests, so the number of requests to connect solar production, increased by over 1,000%. The grid is not capable of dealing with 1,000% increased solar production. You on average, you talk about, but in a setting where people live and there's some offices and maybe some small industries, you can have about 20% of that grid being able to have local production. Then if you add more, there's a risk of the transformer basically exploding because there are the introduction of new power. So, and that kind of brings us to a situation where price per kilowatt hour for solar production goes down, but grid investment cost goes up. So basically you can end up in a situation where you pay the majority of your energy bill is not from what you buy energy for. It is to pay for the distribution. Now, distribution is funded through collective investments, which means that the distribution system operator has a concession right that they have a natural monopoly and is the only actor who can invest in the grid, more or less. This has changed in 2022 in Sweden, but in general, this is the way it looks like in Europe. And they, most often, they don't care how much you use or how much you produce. The connection fee is the same, or the transfer fee of energy per kilowatt hour is the same. So everyone gets an increase. Like you have different fees for how much voltage you need and so on. But in general, like it's just a fixed fee that's equally bad for everyone. So it kind of goes against the idea. It's counterproductive to the idea of 100% renewables and 100% energy communities and so on. So that's kind of like, if we really want to have oil and coal gone, if we want to have, let's say, so you have a ship and you need to run the ship on something, you can have giant batteries, very expensive, probably worked for short travels, right? I would assume that long-term travel though takes for months, like batteries is not a reasonable, but hydrogen could be one. But then you would probably want to connect local renewable production to produce the hydrogen, because if you take oil and coal as the energy source to produce hydrogen, then you just basically, what did you do? Nothing. So the distribution grid is, in my opinion, but you know, it becomes quite nerdy, so someone else might disagree, it's one of the key bottlenecks for the green energy transition for renewable world. Okay. I'll stop there.
No, cool. And I guess like a question to sort of open it up to the two of you as well is sort of like, I guess moving forwards, you mentioned all of these different sort of strategies or things that can be employed to incentivize people in terms of, yes, getting in the solar panels, but no, this doesn't work right now. It's impossible to get this many. So how do we continue to incentivize people to invest in sort of renewable energy and these sustainable, you know, ways of moving forwards when there currently isn't the capacity to actually do that?
Like one of the key things I think is that people like Johan, who has quite some influence, I would guess, in his company, starts to question the local distribution system operator. Like, why is it like this? And also to put, like, to require new technical specification when for how the grid is built. I assume you have a factory somewhere. You probably have some internal grid network, and then see how can that be digitalized in a better way. Real estate owners are some of the most important actors. They have both the incentive and the capacity to say, we want different technologies. I don't think it's necessarily a policy issue in general, but it's that actors who own facilities and own real estates and properties and houses, they say that we are not content with this type of technology that is offered to us. We would like to be able to install as many PVs as we would ever want within where we are. And if your technology does not allow us, we should be able to have other types of technologies to do that, which are coming and existing. But it's kind of about not accepting the status quo, so to say, just because the local DSO says so. And there's nothing bad about DSOs. Like, they have a very, very natural and important role in society. But they've also done this thing without real competition for 100 years. So,
and Johan, maybe in your personal experience, because I know it's slightly different, what sort of strategies do you employ to incentivize, maybe not direct sort of customers per se, but perhaps, you know, your stakeholders within your internal business? How do you sort of incentivize them to invest in the new sustainable and renewable, you know, ways of working that you're currently operating?
Well, you know, I'm from the maritime industry, and, you know, everything that is being done in maritime today is because of decarbonization, right? So, I mean, we were touching here on what kind of fuels the ships will run on the future. And that is a huge topic, because I'm happy that I'm not a ship owner, because there are very high ambitious targets set for the decarbonization in maritime. But no one really knows what the technology or the fuel will be. Will it be? I mean, the first thing that happened is, of course, that we start running ships on LNG, which is still a fossil fuel, but less sulfur in that. But now you're looking at methanol, ammonia, hydrogen, as I said, you know, but no one really knows what is the option for what is the perfect choice for the future. But the ship owners need to invest today, right? They can't wait, because then they will be behind, you know. So a lot of the ship owners will take the wrong decision. We know that, but they have to take a decision, good or bad. They have to do it, right? So, and that, of course, comes very interesting from a training perspective as well, because all these new fuels, there are very little experience out there today of, for example, operating ships on methanol or ammonia. Ammonia is, I would say, 0% knowledge. And that, of course, creates a huge problem for the training industry, because who is going to train the people on all this new technology if there is no experience? So that, of course, creates a business opportunity for us. In Wärtsilä, we are very unique because we have the engine knowledge, but we also have the simulation technology. So, of course, we are at first-hand information, all this, you know. So we could potentially then create all this content for training all the people out there, right? But it's it's for us, it is policy that is the incentive, right? Unfortunately, but that is the way it is in maritime. It's interesting to hear Daniel. I mean, from a personal point of view, I mean, I have my solar panels on my roof in my house, and of course, you know, I followed the discussion last summer about, okay, all the producers have to cover their own costs for the traffic, right? And that came like, are you serious? You know, I mean, this is working totally against for the reason why I bought solar panels in the first. You know, I would like to contribute, but I mean, if it's going to cost for me, you know, then it's not as attractive, right? So yeah, but yeah, very interesting, very interesting.
It's interesting with the shipping industry because I'm just going to go on a tangent here.
Go ahead.
So the interesting about I'm going to make a case for hydrogen, not because I'm a technically savvy person and I know there are stuff that needs to be developed, but the interesting part about hydrogen is not only that you can convert solar into hydrogen and you can run hydrogen. The interesting part is that you can take hydrogen then as a more kind of energy, as I have understood it, you get more higher energy density than a battery, as I've understood it. So if you have a large ship and maybe an oil, not container, was it? Freighter ship, whatever it's called in English.
Tanker.
The interesting part is that you could then go to Qatar or whatever, and then you have lots of PVs, and you produce then the hydrogen, you take it onto the ship. Now you have two options with the ship, basically, and that is to A, just go somewhere, and then you dump it off to the local system, and then you go back. You could probably retrofit the ports that currently deal with it easily, I assume that, but it could also probably open up to have other places, since you don't have to refine the hydrogen, you could probably dump it off. But then if you just, you could theoretically also just convert it. So you do the energy conversion on the ship. So that means that you could also be an energy producer in areas which perhaps currently have a very difficulty in getting energy distributed because of lack of transmission grids, lack of, and so on. And doing the infrastructure investment on place to have the production may be expensive, unsecure, whatever. So I think that it's struck in me that it most probably won't solve a lot of issues in Europe, perhaps, but developing countries, remote areas, you have like the big battery production and green steel production up in the north is quite hard and so on. But if you like get a bunch of big ships and they're full of hydrogen and then they just produce hydrogen or produce energy, given that the business model is there and the kilowatt hour price is actually reasonable to do so in comparison to other one. But I think as a shipping company and so on, I think it might be starting to be an interesting aspect. Like, how do you avoid running empty ships also? Like, what do you do, Iwan? So you have your oil freighter and then you go and you dump off the oil. Do you fill it with something else or just run empty back to home?
Hopefully you have a return cargo, but I mean, if, for example, if you have a crude oil tanker, then you probably leave it and then you go and fill it up somewhere else. But if you are like a product tanker where you ship, I mean, if you refine oil, you know, you get certain amount of different products, you know, and they, you know, in the US, they use a lot of gas. In Europe, we use a lot of diesel, you know, so those go, you know, you typically don't go empty, right? Because that is... Yeah. Insanity to, but yeah, but in some cases, yeah, you do go empty. That's true. But I agree that hydrogen is what I understand. I'm not an expert in fuels, but it seems to be, I think, the number one option in the long term. Now, in short, mid-term, not, but it's a viable option, I would say. But I agree as well. You know, we will see new types of market, you know, and when it comes to things like this, you know, that you can have, the power transition on board the ship, being able to also run the ship on your own cargo, basically. And that's been done today as well, you know, for LNG and methanol tankers, they run on their cargo, basically, right? So that makes sense, of course.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for that, guys. I mean, is there anything else you want to add there, Daniel? You might have had something to say.
I mean, it's, I'm trying to think. So how do you do simulation for R&D for engines also? Like, how does that...
The thing is that when you do simulators for, you know, for engine room operations or liquid cargo, typical, you know, process simulation, right? And when you do it for training, you typically need to have a higher fidelity in modeling than you need for R&D purposes. Hmm. And that is something that we are now exploring within the company, that a lot of the units within Wärtsilä, they want to have the simulator as a black box to basically run. It could be everything from development, verification, certification, pre-integration of systems before you send them out to the ships and so. And today they typically use a physical engine to run those tests, either in the laboratory or they have a partnership with the customer going on board their ship and do the test. And it's extremely expensive, of course, and it takes a lot of time. There's a lot of administration, you know, to get approval to do the testing, etc. And then, of course, you burn a lot of fuel, right? So if we can do more or almost everything in a simulator environment, so of course, we can shift left on basically everything we do, right? So that is what we're looking at now. And since I came from the training industry, I never really thought about, you know, what the fidelity, and I even expected that the fidelity needed to be even greater in R&D. But apparently, we have extremely high fidelity in the training models, you know, which is a little surprising, but interesting and good for us. So it's an easy step for us to, you know, go down rather than up when it comes.
But how do you simulate an engine today in your... Like, do you have a physical engine, or is it a digital version, or how does it?
It's a digital version. It's a digital twin. You can say it's a digital twin. So it's the engine, but also subcomponents to be able to control, you know, automation and control systems, etc., or simulator as well.
And that's done in a VR environment, or is it touch screen, or?
It could be a VR environment, but we typically like mimic a engine control room, where you have all the controls, but then we also simulate the, you know, what we call the local operation post. So basically the engine room, you go out in the engine room and then you have like walkthrough functionality, like in a first person shooter game. Mm. So you go out and open the valve, whatever it can be, right? So
is it like a VR headset then?
Well, you could, or you have it just on, you know, as you play your computer game. So we can deliver both versions. Typically, I would say, you know, when we have the walkthrough. Sorry.
So the transfer of knowledge and experience, like playing a computer contra a VR experience, it's, have you noticed any difference in terms of?
The difference I can say is that if you use the VR goggles and you walk around too much, you get seasick. I would say that, you know, the transfer of knowledge, I cannot see a difference there, to be honest. So in most cases where you have if you have like a walkthrough functionality, I do prefer the more traditional way of just using a keyboard and mouse, or you can even have like an Xbox controller to do that. I think that is better. So
is it because you are training in, how would you say, sequences?
Yes. I mean, if you look at the engine room, it's very much sequence. I mean, there's one way to do things. You need to do this before you do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Right? So it's But then if you look at the navigational simulator for deck officers, there you can solve situations in 500 different ways, right? So it's more, yeah, if you start looking at automating training, it's much more complicated to do it on the navigation side than on the engine or liquid cargo handling, etc., right? Because the latter part, then it's all procedural. You know, you have to do this before you need to close that valve before you open the second valve, etc., etc.
And do you have your own production environment in like if you need to do new CAD models or whatever, or do you do consultants like?
No, we create our own models. We have modeling team, mathematical model teams who knows everything about flow processes, etc., thermo, things like that. And on the navigation side, we have naval architects, hydrodynamic experts, etc. Right, so we create the ship models then to behave correctly in current wind, shallow water effects, and things like that. Right.
So. Do you use, and then I guess you use like Unreal Engine or?
Well,
something like this?
Interesting that you say that. We up to now we have our proprietary Visual Engine, but we are actually moving over to Unreal because we basically can't keep up with the development. Of course, you know.
Yeah.
But everything. So, yeah, so we jump on that train, and that is fantastic. I must say, you know, it's such a great experience too. But we also say that we have done things right, so it's quite easy to do it right. So,
It's impressive how, and it's scary also, but unintended, how Unreal 5 is becoming so good that it's becoming like also an industry behemoth in the sense that that competition is hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you look at high-end visualization primarily, Unreal is, I mean, if we look at where we see, you know, that being tech-driven in simulation is Navy, of course, because they don't have to care about regulations, etc. You know, in Merchant Marine, there are regulations how things should be trained, but, you know, Navy, they don't give a shit about that. They just want to have the best technology. And if you go to the exhibitions where you have naval simulation, I would say 80% of everyone are using Unreal Engine. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that. But I mean, then if you have more simplistic and you more work on maybe visualizing simple processes and so on, then I think, you know, it's easier probably to start with Unity, and they have a very good footprint in that because it's a little bit easier to do things, but you can't do as complex thing as you can do in Unreal. Yeah. That's what I understand. From the discussions we have had, at least. But it's interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Seems like a fun job.
It is.
Like a job most people would be envious of. But I mean, thanks for bringing that question, Daniel. You definitely sparked up a good conversation there. And I guess it would only be fair to move on to Johan yourself now. And maybe the question you brought is perhaps on a bit more of a holistic viewpoint. Why don't you dive into it? Explain it.
I was, you know, when we discussed the topics that were, you know, the optional topics, it was, you know, tech and sustainability or sustainability in technology. And I started asking myself the question, okay, what does it mean actually? And of course, it can mean millions of different things, but instinctively, I start thinking about two things, you know, what it actually means. You know, the first thing is, of course, you know, that we use technology for, you know, improving our operations, our processes become more efficient, basically. And in maritime, that means, you know, less carbon intensive, basically, right? So that could be, you know, that we, you know, the structural design of ships with propulsion systems, you know, that we, you know, the classic achievement thing, you know, want to make it a little bit better and burn less fuels, right? So the structural, more technical part, but then also in the same thing, we also have like the voyage optimization, what we call the route optimization, weather routing, make sure that we have like just in time arrival when we come to the port, so we don't anchor and burn a lot of fuels just lying there waiting. And the thing is, the classic thing is that you start from New York and go into Rotterdam, and you don't know when you will have a spot in the port until maybe when you have done 2/3 or even worse before you reach Rotterdam. which means that the first thing the captain does, he just pull ahead and you just burn fuel. You burn fuel because you need to build up a buffer in case you get an early slot, right? But if you would know already when you leave New York, when your time in port actually is, you know, then you can go soft already from the beginning, and you will save a lot of fuel. Because even if you get, you know, you go full ahead out of New York, and after 10 hours, you get your slot, you know, it's too late. You have burned so much fuel, just unnecessary fuel burning, right? So that's the first thing I see, you know, that we just want to improve things, you know. But then we also have tech that can change behaviors. And there are many examples. And it's quite interesting when we talk about solar, you know, from my own personal experience, you know, that when I got my solar panels and I had tools that visualize how much I produce, et cetera, I also start becoming more, you know, from, you know, optimizing my consumption because, yeah, somehow I get this feedback, you know. And it's the same with my car, you know, when I got my first hybrid car, I totally changed behavior when I drive. You know, I wanted to come as far as I can on the battery, and I didn't care, you know, if I was going 10 below the speed limit or something, you know. So I think that's a quite interesting example. But if you look at what I do with training, something that changed things even for us was COVID. You can imagine the maritime industry is very conservative, and we've been doing training the same way since the introduction of the steam engine. Basically, it's classroom training, in person. Everything is in person, right? Classroom, or if you use a physical simulator or whatever it is, right? But suddenly, you know, the schools were off limits, and you know, there were schools coming up for, you know, it was time for exams and everything, and they just needed to have an alternative solution. And of course, we basically put our classroom simulators up on virtual machines in the cloud, and they can resume. You know, they had to change, you know, it wasn't easy for the schools because they had to change a little bit the methodology and training, etc. And of course, when it comes to assessments, it becomes a little bit difficult because there were no proctoring systems or anything, you know. The schools, of course, you know, when COVID was over, they went back because there's no real incentive for them. But the shipping companies who are doing professional development training, but also had to take care of refresher training for some of the mandatory training, they realized that, wow, we are saving a lot of money not sending people all around the world. Because, I mean, that's how it works in shipping, right? You know, everyone is scattered all over the world. And the training centers, they're also all over the world. So you have to fly in and out people. And there's 750,000 officers in the merchant fleet. And most of them need to attend some kind of training each and every year. So they spend almost as much time in the air as they do on their ships, just flying around doing trainings, right? And of course, not all training can be done on the cloud. You know, we were discussing a little bit earlier about part of the training for some types of training, ship handling, for example. Yeah, you still will need to go to training center to do that. But a lot can be done on the cloud, you know, basic navigation and rules of the road training and things like that, right? And of course, you know, yeah, 10 years ago, we were not able to do that. And that has changed the behavior, especially from the shipping companies, because there is cost saving as well. But it's also, when we talk sustainability, and it's all about retention as well. So we can talk about, of course, environmental sustainability, but also from a work environment perspective, and not having to have your guys flying all over the world when they are off the ships, right? They can stay home with their families and so on. So, yeah, I think just reflect a little bit that it's not only about the tech, it's also about behaviors that tech can enable, right? So that was my take on that.
Cool. And Daniel, do you got a different opinion?
For me personally, I mean, COVID was horrible for lots of people. They died and misery and so on. So I'll accept that. For me personally, it was a great experience because I'm not an office person. I loathe the office. I love working from home. So suddenly it was like it enabled me to not go to the office. And I think that also gave a lot of people, we see the kind of now that people appreciate to be able to go to the office, but they also appreciate a lot to be able to be plan their own life and do the laundry and fix like small social things in your life. And without having to go to the office, like having to spend 40 minutes, 1 hour per day, like if you live close by, just commuting back and forth. So I think that in large part for the office cadre of the world have done a great favor. And finally, so to say, the digital solutions that were already there. I mean, I don't know, how old was I? 2005, 2006, I started to play World of Warcraft. And we used Ventrilo, which is like a voice over IP program. And we coordinated in real life 40 people taking on challenges, and you had to do minute instructions and so on and so forth. And you know, the broadband was not there yet and so on and so forth. But somehow we can manage to do this. But it took another like 20 years plus a pandemic for offices and companies to realize, oh, maybe we actually can do this that way that other people have already been doing for lots of time. But I don't agree with the energy saving part. I mean, it's nice. I know it feels good, but my vision of the world in the future is like unlimited hedonistic use of as much energy you want. If you want to have your heat pump on for 24 hours for a whole year, and you have the local renewable energy production to do it, then obviously you should be able to do it. And a society should promote the unlimited use of free, clean energy rather than energy saving, so to say, because as much when we produce more, we can do more. There's no such thing as unused energy if we can use it. It always gets used up, so to say.
Yeah.
So that would be my ideal world, that you could just more PVs.
Yeah, I mean, energy is not the problem. It's the waste that is the problem, right? That is what we should avoid. I agree.
Okay, cool. Well, I mean, Daniel, I guess coming back to you for a sec as well. I mean, obviously, Johan has just sort of brought the question in, of course, is like, what does tech in sustainability mean? And we've spoken a little bit about it, but you know, he mentioned seeing the two different things, both using it to optimize the current processes, but then also using tech to alter people's behaviors. I guess in your specific role, or the specific, you know, product, let's call it, that you're rolling out in changing the energy grid and all of these things, for yourself, is it more about changing people's behavior to become more tech sustainability savvy in a way, or is it more about optimizing the current process that's in place?
I mean, tech is a tool to solve some issue. Sometimes you develop a technology from basic science that you have no idea what it's good for. For example, the Nobel Prize winner from Japan, I can't remember his name, but he won the Nobel Prize for optical tweezers, basically, or that the concept that two photons can capture a particle. And that's really interesting, but what are you going to do with it? And then other people have developed sort of optical tweezers, which is that you can take lasers and then you can go into fluid and they can capture individual cells and you can move them around, which is great for lab testing. So you have that where you discover the problem after you discover the solution, so to say. But then you also have, as you know, problems, and then you just throw every type of tech that you can imagine on it, like AI, for example. You have a problem, then someone will say AI that is going to solve it. So I think it's more about what problems are you actually trying to fix, and what technology can you use to fix those problems? And is that technology actually relevant to use to fix that problem? I think perhaps there's a technology is awesome, but it doesn't replace the pen and paper. It's pen and paper is still amazingly great, and especially for the human brain in terms of muscle memory and creativity and so on, and writing, and it helps and so on. So tech is a tool. It's a hammer. Sometimes it needed to be used to nudge people into new behavioral patterns. Sometimes you need to like radically transform the world, such as the internet. So it kind of depends. Boring answer, perhaps. It depends. Technology in what hands? I mean, if you take a very kind of nature sustainability kind of person, nudging towards less consumption is a good thing. And then you try to use technology for, how would you say, I would like to call it negative nudging. A negative, not because it's bad for you, it's just that you go on minus, you consume less, you eat less, not eat less, but you know, all of those things. And then perhaps you have a person like me that would say, no, but we should use technology to live in overabundance. We should be, do all, I don't know if I'm the best person ever, but it kind of also like it's in the eye of the beholder. So in many ways, like if you do nudging for what? If you don't like to do nudging, am I just defending my own position that I don't want to do energy efficiency in my house, for example?
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely understand. And from obviously my understanding, you're talking about sustainability is the issue. Tech is the bonus of solving it. There's other ways of being more sustainable, essentially.
Might be.
Yeah, might be.
Yeah, I mean, the interaction of the tech always disrupts something else, you know, as well. You know, it can destroy something, but that could be a business opportunity itself, right? You know? Or many people use that as a business opportunity, unfortunately, as well. But yeah.
Perfect. Well, I guess that kind of wraps up the two questions that you guys have brought. If there's nothing else which you guys kind of want to discuss, I guess we could sort of wrap it up here. If you guys have nothing else, perfect. Well, like I said, to conclude this podcast, I mean, before we end, I'd like to, of course, thank both of our guests for sharing their thoughts. Again, to everybody listening at home, it's been Daniel Brand and Johan Ekvall. I'm sure if you have any further questions for them, they're both on LinkedIn. I know they are because that's how I found them. So go and pepper them with questions over there. I'm sure they won't mind. But I mean, other than that, from Evolution side, if you are hiring for new technical roles, or if you're looking for a new role, feel free to get in touch with us here. Or if yourself or anyone you know might be someone cool to be featured on a future podcast, you can drop me a message too. I'm Jacob Byerly. You can find me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at jacob.byerly@evolution-nordics.com, or you can just visit us at evolutionjobs.com. Thanks again to both of our guests for joining, and thank you guys at home for listening. We hope you can join us next time.